but profit remained flat. Wallerstein was frustrated. He didn't understand what it would take to entice his customers to buy more. Then one evening, he had an epiphany. Maybe people wanted more popcorn, but didn't want to be seen eating two bags of it. Perhaps they feared that buying a second bag might make them appear piggish. Wallerstein decided that if he could find a way to circumvent their aversion to buying a second bag, it would help his profitability. It was easy. Just offer a larger bag. And so Wallerstein introduced a new size of popcorn to the movie-going world. Jumbo. The results astonished him. Not only did popcorn sales immediately shoot upward, but so did sales of that other high-profit treat, Coca-Cola. Wallerstein had unearthed what is a basic law in the food industry today. People will gorge themselves on enormous quantities of food if enormous is one of the serving sizes offered. In the Bible, gluttony is a sin, but apparently people consider a restaurant menu to be a higher authority, and if it offers an 8-scoop banana split, that gives permission. Economists write many scholarly articles, usually starting with the assumption that people act rationally, which in reality excludes everyone except those with certain rare brain disorders. Wallerstein, on the other hand, uncovered a truth about actual human behavior. Did the food industry give him a trophy for the new idea and adopt the Wallerstein strategy? Nope. In his classic book, The Structure of Scientific Revolutions, Thomas Kuhn wrote about what he called paradigm shifts in science. These are alterations in scientific thinking that represent more than incremental advances. They are alterations of the framework of thinking, of the set of shared concepts and assumptions within which scientists do their theorizing, until the next paradigm shift. To solve problems and draw conclusions within an existing framework requires a blend of analytical and elastic thinking. But the act of envisioning a new framework for thought relies heavily on the elastic component, on skills such as imagination and integrative thinking. Paradigm shifts are peculiar in that they leave many previously successful people behind, people whose rigidity of thought causes them to cling to the old framework to which they are accustomed, despite often overwhelming evidence that the paradigm shift is valid. Or sometimes, those who cannot accept the shift form the vast majority, and its implementation is blocked or delayed. That was the fate of Wallerstein's ideas. Wallerstein's approach to selling snacks represented a paradigm shift for the food industry. Though it seems obvious today, it was heresy back then. In the 1960s, people viewed consuming large amounts of food as unattractive, and executives couldn't accept the idea that with their nudging, that might change, that it was simply the act of having to purchase the second helping that stood in the way of unbridled consumption. What's more, many food executives saw larger portion size as a form of discounting, an act that conventional wisdom told them would hurt the view of theirs as a quality brand. As a result, Wallerstein's innovation didn't catch on elsewhere. Even when Wallerstein himself landed at McDonald's in the mid-1970s, nothing changed. He couldn't convince Ray Kroc, the McDonald's founder, to introduce a larger size of French fries. "If people want more fries," Kroc said, "they can buy two bags." McDonald's continued to resist, but finally adopted the strategy in 1990. By then, what had come to be called supersizing had become the new conventional wisdom. But it had taken the food industry longer to recognize the law of human gluttony than it took the physics community to embrace the theory of relativity. In hindsight, the mental adjustment to a framework of thought in which large portions are the standard seems easy. So does the idea of chocolate chip cookies, now that someone has invented them. The Structure of Personal Revolutions. In The Structure of Scientific Revolutions, Kuhn wrote that scientists hold institutionalized everyday beliefs, which may, on occasion, be altered by a transformational discovery. But that is also true of us in our personal lives. We each developed our point of view on common issues during our first few decades of life, or our first few years in a new job. We form a framework to apply those ideas, and apply them when we're called upon to draw conclusions in those realms. For some, those paradigms never evolve. But for the fortunate, they do change, often in Kuhnian jumps. Those who are open to such personal paradigm shifts, to altering their attitudes and beliefs, have always had an advantage in life, because they are more able to adapt to changing circumstances. In today's society, that is especially important. To aid my ability in that regard, I sometimes engage in a little mental flexibility exercise. I list some of my strongly held beliefs on slips of paper. I fold them, pick one, and imagine someone telling me that the belief written on it is false. Of course, I don't for a moment think my belief is really wrong. That's just the point. When my instinct to reject the notion that I'm wrong kicks in, that's when I'm in the position of all those who, in the past, failed to adapt to challenges to the ideas that they, too, held firmly. That's when I push myself and try harder to be open to the possibility that I'm mistaken. Why do I hold that belief? Are there those who don't? Do I respect them, or at least some of them? Why might they have come to a different conclusion? I tried to recall times in the past when I was wrong about something, even though I'd been confident of being right. The bigger the mistake, the better. The process helps me to understand that the mental adjustment to a new thought paradigm isn't as easy as hindsight always makes it seem. The exercise led me to challenge myself, for example, on the question of immigration. My parents emigrated from Poland after the war, as it was called in my household. All their friends were also immigrants and Holocaust survivors. When I started school, I could distinguish a Hungarian from a Czech, but I had never met an adult who was a natural-born American. I thought it was normal to eat brisket on Thanksgiving, and I was sent to speech therapy because I spoke with a Polish accent that my teachers mistook for a speech impediment. Owing to that background, I've always been in favor of our country's accepting the tired and poor, and, after that, if there's still room, the powerful and rich. I want to grant to others the opportunities that my family was given. I felt anger toward those who feel otherwise, especially when, during the 2016 presidential election campaign, the talk turned to building a wall along the Mexican border. That was how matters stood when, in one of my mental flexibility exercises, I picked a slip that read, "The supporters of building a wall with Mexico are evil." I remember rolling my eyes. There was no way I was wrong about this one. But I dutifully put on my scientist cap and tried to examine the argument for the wall as if it were a scientific issue, devoid of human relevance. At first I pondered all the disputes over the data on the contributions of immigrants, or the efficacy or cost of a wall. But then I decided that those were side issues. My belief was not rooted in such data, but in my feeling that a wall was simply an affront to what I wanted this country to stand for. What would all those evil people on the other side say to that? I started to watch Fox News to find out. Almost hidden in all the noise was what I concluded to be their basic logic. We have laws about immigration. If we don't like them, we should change them. But as long as we have them, if they are ineffective, it makes sense to consider new means of enforcing them. I realize that if you find that logic compelling, it does not necessarily mean that you are the type who kicks dogs and pulls the wings off flies. We tend to make quick initial assessments of issues based on the assumptions of the paradigms we follow. When people challenge our assessment, we tend to push back. Whatever our politics, the more we argue with others, the further we can dig in and sometimes vilify those who disagree. Then, we reinforce our ideas by preaching to the choir, our friends. But the mental flexibility to consider theories that contradict our beliefs and don't fit our existing paradigms, not only can make you a genius in science, it is also beneficial in everyday life. In the business world, accepting challenges to old ways is equally important, because industries are quickly evolving. Apple, for instance, is a corporation that makes and sells products. As a result, it is classified by the U.S. government as a manufacturing company. But that classification is based on what has become an outdated way of thinking. For though the company gets the bulk of its revenue from selling physical products, virtually all of Apple's products are manufactured for it by others. Adopting a 21st century model, Apple thus avoids having to invest in factories and is better positioned to change directions nimbly, gaining an advantage over less forward-thinking competition. Or look at Nike. It is heading toward what, until recently, seemed a science fiction-like manufacturing model. 3D printing. Within the company, they call the initiative the Manufacturing Revolution. Partnering with HP in 2016, Nike has already employed the technology for prototyping new designs, and it is looking forward to a future in which 3D printing and 3D knitting are combined to create shoes on the spot, in store, and custom tailored to the precise measurements of each person's feet. Like Apple, Nike presents an existential challenge to any competitor that follows the old principle that one should not question assumptions and methodologies that have, in the past, led to success. Reimagining our frames of thought. I was always surprised, when attending a Christian church service, at how quiet the worshipers were. We Jews like to talk. And so at synagogues, the rabbi is often in a position of having to pound his or her fist on the podium to quiet the din. One time, in a sermon, the rabbi addressed this. If you would ask me if it is acceptable to socialize with your neighbors while praying, I would say I'd rather you didn't. You are here to worship, and your banter is distracting, if not disrespectful, he said. But if you were to ask me, is it okay to go to the synagogue and pray while you socialize with your friends, I'd say, certainly. We're always happy to have you. He went on to a lengthy discussion of Talmudic principles, the kind of microscopic dissections of issues you get used to if you attend synagogue. But to me, the point was that the way you frame an issue has a profound influence on the results of your analysis. Consider these four brain teasers from a 2015 study in the Journal of Problem Solving. To solve them, like Wallerstein, you will have to question your assumptions and alter your framework of thinking. If you enjoy riddles, give them a try. I'll give you a few seconds between the riddles to digest each one. 1. A man is reading a book when the lights go off, but even though the room he is in is pitch dark, the man goes on reading. How? By the way, the book was not in an electronic format. 2. A magician claimed to be able to throw a ping pong ball so that it would go a short distance, come to a dead stop, and then reverse itself. He added that he would not accomplish this by bouncing the ball off any object, tying anything to it, or giving it spin. How could he perform this feat? 3. Two mothers and two daughters were fishing. They managed to catch one big fish, one small fish, and one fat fish. Since only three fish were caught, how was it possible that each woman caught her own fish? 4. Marcia and Marjorie were born on the same day, of the same month, of the same year, to the same mother and the same father. Yet they are not twins. How is that possible? In the study I quoted, each of these brain teasers was solved, on average, by fewer than half the subjects. The reason the riddles are difficult is that each of them suggests, in most people's minds, a certain picture. The first one suggests a man staring into a book. The second one suggests a man tossing a ping pong ball onto a table or the ground. The third one suggests a group of four women, two mothers and two daughters. And the fourth one suggests a pair of twins, Marcia and Marjorie. These pictures determine our framework of thought as we try to find the answers. As long as we adhere to them, the ideas that our associative brains pass to our consciousness will be consistent with them. But these pictures are incorrect interpretations of the circumstances described by the riddles. To solve the riddles, these preconceptions must be abandoned. What makes riddles so difficult is that they are deliberately designed so that the wrong interpretation will come to mind automatically, with little or no conscious consideration. It's the interpretation our brains deem the most likely to be appropriate based on past experience, a hidden assumption we are unaware of even making. But it is a picture that is inconsistent with the novel situation envisioned in the riddle. Like many challenging problems, the riddles are made difficult not by what we don't know, but what we do know, or think we know, which turns out to be incorrect. Take the first riddle. In the great majority of circumstances that most of us encounter, a man who is reading a book is indeed staring at its pages. But though that is one possible scenario described by the riddle, as we'll soon see, there is another possibility. And to realize this and let go of that initial picture is the key to success. That's analogous to the dynamics of paradigm shifts in business and science. In those fields, changing circumstances invalidate assumptions that are so ingrained that people don't question them or have trouble accepting that they no longer hold. Success comes to those who realize this and can revise their understanding of the situation. Here are the solutions to the riddles. In the first, the man did not require light to read because he was blind and was reading the book in Braille. In the second, the magician threw the ball upward into the air, not horizontally, so its motion was reversed by gravity and did not need a collision with the ground, a table, or a wall. In the third, only three fish were caught because the two mothers and two daughters constituted only three women, a girl, her mother, and the mother's mother. And in the fourth, Marcia and Marjorie did not represent the entire brood. They weren't twins, but triplets. We encounter many challenges in life. We know how to deal with some because we have bumped into them before. Others are novel, but can be overcome through straightforward analytical thinking. But some problems have withstood our attempts at solution. Often, as in these riddles, that is because no solution exists within the framework in which people have thought about them. But a solution could be found if one adopted a new point of view. When we talk about triumphs of intellect, we tend to focus on brilliant analytical thinking, the kind of thought produced by powerful logic. But rarely do we recognize the contribution of being able to reimagine the framework in which our thinking occurs, the terms in which our mind defines the issue we are considering. That's the product of elastic thinking, a task that requires that squishy ability called judgment. Creating new representations is difficult to automate, and most animals have trouble doing it, but it is often the key to successful problem solving in the human world. The dog and bone problem. In this age, issues that require us to alter our framework of thought are more common than ever before. That's what disruptive change is all about. It is change that demands new paradigms and different ways of thinking. Psychologists call the process of altering the framework through which you analyze an issue restructuring. That most fundamental operation of our minds often spells the difference between finding an answer and reaching an impasse. Or, once you've reached an impasse, restructuring is often the only way to overcome it. Today, as the assumptions of the past are being rendered obsolete at a blinding pace, the ability to restructure your thinking is less and less a requirement for standout achievement and more simply a requirement for survival. Computer scientist Douglas Hofstadter illustrates the importance of restructuring with what he calls the dog and bone problem. Imagine you're a dog, and a kind human has just tossed you a bone, but it landed in the neighbor's yard, just on the other side of a 10-foot-tall chain-link fence. Behind you is an open gate. Before you is a tasty snack. Your mouth waters as you look at the bone, but how do you get to it? Unless they have encountered this problem before, most dogs will represent the situation in a strict geographical sense. They make an internal map of their own location and the bones. They have an idea of the distances on that map, and they have a goal of moving over time to diminish that distance. The dog might start out 30 feet from the bone. As the dog moves toward it, that distance will decrease, and the dog concludes from its innate programming that when the distance gets to zero, it will have reached its target. A dog, or a robot, with that program will run toward the bone until it encounters the fence, at which point it will have reached an impasse. Its distance from the bone may have diminished to just a matter of inches, but it can proceed no farther. Some dogs will then just stare at the bone and bark in frustration, or roll over and wait for you to pet their belly. Others, possessing the concept of digging as a way of traveling under obstacles, might try doing just that. But some bright dogs will possess enough mental elasticity to change the framework through which they think of the situation. They will realize that their physical distance from the bone is not the same as their distance from their goal. Standing at the fence, these dogs realize that, although they are just a few inches from the bone, they are far from being able to reach it. And so they will change the notion of distance they employ for the purpose of this problem. They will understand that, although they are standing physically near the bone, the open gate is closer to the bone, in the sense of achieving their goal, than they are. So rather than employ literal geometric distance as a gauge of progress, they will use a definition of distance in what cognitive scientists call problem space. In this case, the distance in problem space is the distance along a path that will take them to the bone. In problem space, if the dog begins by moving toward the bone, it will be increasing its distance from its goal. But if it moves toward the open gate, it will be diminishing it. And so dogs that create this new framework will race to the open gate. Solving the dog and bone problem, once it is effectively framed, is easy, but realizing that a new framework is needed and then creating one requires elastic thinking. Effective thinking often boils down to that, the ability to restructure your framework of thought about the facts and issues. And so the dog and bone problem, though simple, separates the thinkers from the non-thinkers, the humans and bright dogs from the chess-playing computers. How mathematicians think. If there is one field whose bread and butter is restructuring, and that can therefore teach us much about innovation and creative thought, it is mathematics. Most of us have no idea how mathematicians think, but we can learn a lot from their deftness at creating alternative frameworks for difficult problems. Take this problem, which is illustrated in the PDF. It is really a mathematics problem, but it masquerades as an everyday riddle. You have an 8x8 checkerboard and 32 dominoes. Each domino can cover two horizontally or vertically adjacent squares, and it is easy to see how one might place them in a manner that covers all 64 squares on the checkerboard. Now imagine that you toss away one domino and remove two squares from the checkerboard from two diagonally opposite corners. Can you cover the remaining 62 squares with 31 dominoes? Whether your answer is yes or no, explain how you know that. No domino is allowed to stick out past the boundary of the board. When presented with this problem, most people try various arrangements of the dominoes and then, after failing, suspect that covering the entire board is impossible. But how to prove it? Trying one failed configuration after another won't do it because there are too many possibilities. This mutilated checkerboard riddle is a kind of human upgrade of the simple dog and bone problem. There is an easy answer, but it involves looking at the issue within a new framework, restructuring the question in a manner that abandons the literal attempts to cover the board and instead formulates the problem in a new way. How? The key is this. Instead of framing the problem as a search through the space of ways to cover the checkerboard with dominoes, frame it instead as a search through the space of laws that govern the act of placing dominoes on the board. Of course, first you'll have to formulate those laws. Here is one. Each domino covers two squares. Can you think of others? Once you've identified all the laws you can think of, there aren't that many, look at the issue of whether you can cover the entire mutilated board in the context of those laws. You'll find that there is a law that would have to be violated in order to cover the entire mutilated board. And so the answer is no, you cannot do that. If you thought of the following law, you probably solved the riddle. Because each domino covers two adjacent squares, each domino, when placed on the board, must cover one black square and one white square. That simple law means that there is no way to place the dominoes on the board in a manner that covers an unequal number of black and white squares. The complete checkerboard has an equal number of white and black squares, so this law doesn't preclude you from covering it with dominoes. But the mutilated board, with two opposite corners removed, has 32 white squares and 30 black squares, or vice versa. So the law tells us that there is no way to cover it. The annals of mathematics, and much of problem solving in all fields, can be viewed as a relentless series of assaults on unhelpful frameworks, employing the weapon of restructuring. Here's an example from real mathematics. What is the solution of the equation x squared equals minus 1? Since the square of any number is a positive number, asking someone to solve that problem seems to be like saying, you have 2 pounds of flounder and a carrot. How do you make beef stew? For centuries, mathematicians assumed there was no answer. But they were all working within the framework of ordinary mathematics, which we today call the real numbers. In the 16th century, Italian mathematician Raphael Bombelli realized that the fact that the square root of minus 1 is not a number that we can count on our fingers doesn't mean it is a number that cannot be useful to our minds. After all, we use negative numbers, and those don't correspond to a number of fingers or to any physical quantity. 500 years ago, that was Bombelli's great restructuring, to look at numbers as abstractions that obey rules, rather than as concrete entities. And so, Bombelli questioned whether there might be some legitimate mathematical framework of numbers that allows for the square root of minus 1, without regard for whether such numbers could be used to count or measure things. Bombelli probed the issue by saying, suppose such a number does exist. Does that lead to a logical contradiction? And if not, what would that number's properties be? He found that a number satisfying x squared equals minus 1 does not lead to a logical contradiction, and he successfully discovered some of its novel properties. Today we write Bombelli's number as I and call it an imaginary number. Imaginary numbers are a fundamental cornerstone of many fields of mathematics, and they play a critical role in most of physics. For example, they are the natural way to describe wave phenomena. Thus, without imaginary numbers, we would probably have no quantum theory, and hence no electronics, and so the modern world as we know it would not exist. Imaginary numbers are now taught as elementary math. Advanced high school students have no trouble learning what the most advanced medieval scholars could not fathom, and many could not accept, because, like the idea of jumbo sizes, it contradicted the paradigm of conventional thought. The influence of culture. The stories of Wallerstein and Bombelli couldn't be more different, yet they both illustrate that one important influence on our ability to arrive at new representations comes from outside ourselves, from our professional, social, and cultural norms. They can be the norms of our family, our peers, our country, our ethnicity, our field of expertise, or even the particular company we work for. We tend to think that national and ethnic culture exerts the biggest influence on an individual's thinking. But if you know any mathematicians, they probably think quite differently from the lawyers you know, who think very differently from the chefs, accountants, police detectives, and poets you know, and those differences can be just as great. Whatever its source, the influence of culture is so powerful, it affects even our perception of physical objects. Consider a recent study by University of Michigan psychologist Shinobu Kitayama and colleagues, who studied the differences in how European American and Japanese American subjects perceive simple geometrical figures. Culture is to a group what personality is to an individual. European culture, psychologists have found, stresses independence and literal thinking, while the Japanese culture is more communal and stresses situation and context. To investigate the cognitive consequences of those differences, in one set of experiments, Kitayama showed his subjects a, quote, standard box drawn on a sheet of paper with a line segment precisely one-third the height of the box drawn vertically down from its top border, as is illustrated in your PDF. The subjects were also given their own sheet of paper, which had an outline of a similar box on it. That box was a different size than the standard box and had no line hanging down from the box's top. Each subject was given a pencil and asked to replicate the vertical line of the standard box within his or her box. Since the box they were given was of a different size, there were two ways to do this. Some were asked to draw a line of the same length as on the standard. Others were asked to draw a line of the same proportion. In other words, one-third of the height of the box that framed it. Those two requests differed in an essential way. In the former, one can ignore the box, while in the latter, the relation of the box and the line are paramount. The two different ways of drawing the line are illustrated in your PDF. The researchers designed their study around this difference because the box is the context for the line, and context is the element that is stressed in Japanese culture. Kitayama thus predicted that the Japanese would do better than the Europeans when asked to match proportion, but not when told to match the line by length. And that is exactly how the experiment turned out. Kitayama's study probed how people think in an artificial laboratory setting. But cultural differences that reach as deep as one's physical perception are bound to profoundly affect the way different people approach problems in their respective societies. So, sociologists asked, does culture affect a society's level of innovation? If so, the relative ranking of countries with regard to innovation should be stable over time, reflecting each society's underlying culture. The table in your PDF displays the results of one study that addressed that issue. It ranks the United States and 13 European countries of roughly comparable wealth with regard to the number of inventions patented per capita over the decade 1971 through 1980. It shows that most retain their same rank over the entire decade. The study was no fluke. For example, analogous rankings were obtained by other researchers and for a different decade, 1995 to 2005, as you can see in the table in your PDF. In this study, only a subclass of inventions was studied, so the two tables are not directly comparable, but what is important is that the rankings are similar and they are also stable over time. Our culture can provide an approach to issues that will help us see solutions, but it can also hinder us. A strong cultural identity, if it produces a deeply ingrained approach to problems, can make it more difficult to change that approach, even if it is not working. On the other hand, exposing yourself to other cultures is beneficial, because those who grew up or work within a different culture will often have different attitudes toward life, and studies show that simply interacting with such people can open our minds and increase our elasticity of thought. The broader perspective that such exposure brings makes us more likely to break our old patterns and free ourselves from rigid thought patterns that may be holding us back. But whether we need a new framework to shape our thinking or can find the solution within our existing structure of thought, where do the ideas we seek come from? As the next chapter explains, the process of idea generation is seated deep within our unconscious mind and is most active when our conscious processes of analytical thought are at rest. Chapter 6. Thinking when you're not thinking. Nature's Plan B. Lying in her bed in the village of Coligny near Lake Geneva in Switzerland, Mary Godwin felt frustrated. It was past 2 in the morning, another dreary night in a dreary rainy month of June. The incessant rain was nothing new to her. She'd grown up in London and had also spent considerable time in Scotland. But on this night, the gloom of the weather reflected her mood. Mary, a pale, dainty woman with auburn hair and deep hazel eyes, was being hard on herself. The year was 1816, and she was only 18 years old. She had come to spend that summer in Switzerland with her half-sister, her friends, and her lover. Late one night, during a particularly wild downpour, they had all gathered around a log fire to read aloud from a volume of ghost stories, and then decided that they'd each write one. By the next night, everyone but Mary had their stories. Days passed. The others kept asking, "Have you thought of a story?" And she kept having to reply with a mortifying negative. She began to feel unworthy of the intellectual company of her friends and lover. The insecurities only fed her frustration. Mary's friends continued their late-night fireside ruminations, and on the night in question, they spoke of the nature and principle of life. They mused about some experiments by Erasmus Darwin, in which he had supposedly preserved a piece of vermicelli in a glass case, till by some extraordinary means it began to move with voluntary motion. On reading those words, my reaction was that we've all had leftovers like that. But this was an intellectual group, and they wondered, Could life be created so simply? And by what force? Sometime around midnight, they all went to sleep, all but Mary, that is, who lay in bed, staring at the ceiling. She couldn't sleep, but she shut her eyes and resolved to maintain a quiet mind. It was time to take a pause from her efforts at creating a story. It was while Mary was in that relaxed state of mind that the outline of the story she had been seeking suddenly came to her. Apparently inspired by the night's musings, she would recall, "My imagination, unbidden, possessed and guided me," Mary said. "I saw with shut eyes, but acute mental vision, the pale student of unhallowed arts kneeling beside the thing he had put together." Mary Godwin, who would become, after marrying her lover, Mary Shelley, had had the vision that in 1818 would lead her to her book, Frankenstein, or The Modern Prometheus. Every creation begins life as a challenge, just as every answer begins as a question. As we saw in Chapter 3, there is a lot in common among the desire to paint a canvas, solve a problem, invent a device, produce a business plan, or prove a point in physics. What these endeavors also share is that, if we endure the same intense discomfort and frustration that Mary Shelley felt, from deep within the recesses of our elastic mind, an idea may suddenly come. The elastic thinking that produces ideas doesn't consist of a linear train of steps as analytical thought does. Sometimes big, sometimes inconsequential, sometimes in crowds, sometimes as loners, our ideas just seem to appear. But ideas don't come from nowhere. They are produced in our unconscious minds. To Mary, the mode of thought that led her to her first rough but inspired vision of Frankenstein was shrouded in magic and mystery. How could the story, which she had struggled for days to create, come to her as she rested in bed, thinking about nothing in particular? Before the advent of neuroscience and the technology that made neuroscience possible, it was enormously difficult to understand how a daydream or a wandering mind could produce answers when our conscious efforts had failed to do so. But today, we know that quiet brains are not idle brains, that in periods of mental peace, our unconscious may be overflowing with activity. Today, 200 years after the origin of Frankenstein, we can measure and monitor the physical underpinnings of that activity. We understand that, magical as it may seem to be, thinking while we are not consciously focused is a fundamental feature of the mammalian brain, possessed even by lowly and primitive rodents. Known as the brain's default mode of thought, it is a key mental process in elastic thinking. The dark energy of the brain. Marcus Raichel calls what he has been studying for the past 20 years, dark energy. In astrophysics, the term dark energy refers to something mysterious that permeates all of space and constitutes two-thirds of all the energy in the universe, yet goes unseen in everyday life. As a result, it went unnoticed through centuries of astronomy and physics until it was discovered by accident in the late 1990s. But Raichel is a neuroscientist, not an astronomer, and the energy he has been studying is the dark energy of the brain, the energy of the brain's default mode. The analogy is apt because, like the astrophysicist's dark energy, the dark energy of the default mode is a kind of background energy. It is energy that arises from the background of cerebral activity. And it too, despite being substantial, was long hidden from us because the default mode is not activated during everyday activity. Instead, it becomes active when the executive brain is not directing our analytical thought processes to anything in particular. There is currently an explosion of research on the default mode, the result of a series of papers Raichel wrote when he was just a few years into his work on the topic, in 2001. As I write this, his initial article has been cited more than 7,000 times, an average of more than one new scientific paper on the subject each day, each of them the product of months or years of work. But, like many scientific breakthroughs, the concept of the default mode swam unheralded in that great sea of scientific ideas long before Raichel rediscovered it and published the paper that brought it to the level of prominence it has today. The tale begins in 1897, when a 23-year-old fresh out of graduate school took a position in the psychiatry clinic at the University of Jena in Germany. His specialty was neuropsychiatry. With roots in the 17th century work of Thomas Willis, it is the study of how one might connect mental disorders to specific processes in the brain. The only way to observe those processes in 1897 was to saw open a skull, so people weren't exactly flocking to that field. But that young psychiatrist would change that while working in Jena for the next 41 years and creating the first great technological tool of neuroscience. Hans Berger's colleagues described him as shy, reticent, inhibited, brooding, detail-oriented, and highly self-critical. One said he was obviously fond of his instruments and physical apparatus and somewhat afraid of his patients. Another, who would later serve as a subject in Berger's experiments, said that Berger would never take any step that was not in accordance with his routine. His days resembled one another like two drops of water. Year after year, he delivered the same lectures. He was the personification of static. And yet, Berger had a secret and audacious interior life. In his diary, he made wildly unorthodox scientific speculations. He interspersed them with original poetry and spiritual reflections. And in his research, which he kept secret from virtually everyone, he pursued what were, for his day, shocking scientific ideas. One was connected to an experience he had when he was 20 years old and serving in the military. During a training exercise, Berger had been thrown from his horse and narrowly escaped death. That same evening, he received a telegram from his father, the first he had ever gotten from anyone in his family, inquiring about his health. As he later learned, his sister, who lived far away, had urged their father to contact him, because that same morning she had been struck by a sudden attack of apprehension about his safety. The confluence of events convinced Berger that somehow his own terror had been communicated to his sister. As he wrote many years later, it was a case of spontaneous telepathy in which, at a time of mortal danger, and as I contemplated certain death, I transmitted my thoughts, while my sister, who was particularly close to me, acted as the receiver. After that, he became obsessed with trying to understand how the energy of human thought can be transmitted from one person to another. Today, the concept of mental telepathy sounds unscientific because it has long since been thoroughly investigated and discredited. In Berger's era, however, the evidence against it was far thinner. In any case, what ultimately defines the value of an investigation in science is not what is being investigated, but how carefully and intelligently the research is done. Berger went about his research with the same strict scientific rigor that his colleagues always attributed to him. But in order to bring that rigor to an understanding of the energy transformations in the nervous system and correlate them to mental experience, he had to find a way to measure the brain's energy. Although no one had ever tackled that problem before, Berger had a brilliant idea about how to do it. Inspired by the work of physiologist Angelo Mosso, Berger reasoned that since metabolism requires oxygen, he could measure blood flow as a proxy for energy. That principle was almost 100 years ahead of its time. It is the key to the functional magnetic resonance imaging technology, fMRI, that helped launch the neuroscience revolution in the 1990s. Of course, fMRI depends on massive superconducting magnets, powerful computers, and a theoretical design based on quantum theory, none of which were available to Berger when he began his investigations in the early 20th century. All Berger had to work with were items of the sort you might find today in a middle school physics lab, plus a saw. How could he observe blood flow in the brain with that? The answer is gruesome, but that's where Berger got lucky. The Jena clinic where he worked put him in regular contact with patients who, due to either a tumor or often an equestrian accident, had to have a bit of their skull removed in the course of their treatment. One man's ceiling may be another man's floor, but here, one man's craniotomy was another man's window to the brain. Berger's first experimental subject was a 23-year-old factory worker with an 8-centimeter diameter gap in his skull, the result of 2 surgical attempts to remove the lodged bullet. Though the man suffered from intermittent seizures, he was cognitively unaffected. With the man's permission, Berger fashioned a small rubber bladder, filled it with water, and affixed it snugly within the hole in the man's head. He connected the bladder to a device designed to record changes in its volume. When blood flowed to the area of the brain beneath the bladder, the brain would swell slightly and compress it. Berger asked his patient to perform tasks such as simple mental arithmetic, counting spots on the opposite wall, and anticipating being touched across the ear by a feather. He called the thoughts required for those tasks voluntary concentration, and he measured blood flow to the brain as the patient performed them. Berger also measured blood flow due to, quote, involuntary attention. His protocol for that was not as innocuous. He stepped behind his unsuspecting subject and fired a gun. If the field of neuropsychiatry had a code of ethics back then, the bar must have been set pretty low. In addition to being hard on the patients, Berger's experiments were plagued by technical problems. Over the years, they led to some publications, such as a 1910 book, Investigations on the Temperature of the Brain, in which he argued that the chemical energy of the brain can be converted into heat, work, and electrical psychic energy. But his conclusions and his data were weak, and he was battered with self-doubt and fighting depression. By 1920, Berger had gotten bolder. He explored brain function by inserting an electrode into patients' brains in order to deliver an electric current. The plan was to correlate brain geography with what the subject experienced when various cortical locations were stimulated by the weak current. He was conducting such experiments on the brain of a 17-year-old college student in June 1924 when he had an epiphany. Why not remove the electrodes from the cortical stimulator and attach the electrodes instead to a device used to measure electrical current? In other words, he turned the tables. Rather than send current into the brain, the new setup would allow him to study the brain's own electricity. That proved to be the key to Berger's success because, over the next 5 years, he learned to make those readings from outside the skull by attaching electrodes to a subject's scalp. As one might imagine, that greatly increased his pool of volunteers. It was a tool that could be used on anyone, and indeed, he made thousands of readings, including many, on his own son. Berger called his device the electroencephalograph, or EEG. In 1929, at the age of 56, Berger finally published his first paper on that research, on the electroencephalogram of man. In the next decade, he would publish 14 more papers, each with the same title, distinguishing them only by number. Berger's EEG was one of the most influential inventions of the 20th century. It opened a window to the brain, enabling neuropsychiatry to become a true science. Today, scientists regularly employ the EEG to study mental processes like those that transpired in Mary Shelley's brain that night as she relaxed her mind. But Berger himself made the first big discovery in that regard. Employing his new device, Berger demonstrated that the brain is active even when a person is not engaging in conscious thought, when the mind is daydreaming or wandering, as Mary Shelley's was when her ideas came to her. Even more unexpected was the fact that the electrical energy characteristic of that inactive state, as measured by the EEG, subsided the moment voluntary concentration began, or if a subject's attention was drawn to some event in the surrounding environment. Berger's ideas were contrary to the scientific wisdom of the day, which held that the brain was electrically active only during tasks that demanded attention. He preached about the importance of his new discovery, but few listened. Scientists knew that when people were not thinking, there must be some residual brain activity to enable functions such as breathing and heartbeat to continue. And they assumed that whatever else Berger's EEG detected was just random noise. That view was not unreasonable, and yet, had others been more open-minded, they'd have realized, as Berger did, that the signal was not random. Sadly, this was an instance of an existing paradigm getting in the way of intellectual progress, an all-too-common story. By the late 1930s, Berger's work on the EEG had spawned a huge field, but no one studied the energy of the resting brain. Contemporary research had progressed in other directions, and Berger was left behind. Then, on September 30, 1938, while making the rounds in his clinic, Berger was abruptly called to the telephone and told by the Nazi-approved authorities that he was being fired the next day. Shortly thereafter, his laboratory was dismantled. In May 1941, with World War II in full swing, his career halted by the Nazis, and the field of EEG research not moving in the direction he wanted, Berger wrote in his diary, "I have sleepless nights in which I keep brooding and struggling with self-accusations. I am unable to read or work in any organized way, but I want to force myself, for like this, it is unbearable." His career effectively over, Berger felt he had not been successful at his lifelong goal of connecting the electrical processes of the brain to what is experienced in the mind. He'd made a major step along that path with his discovery of the electrical energy of the brain during daydreaming, but he'd been unable to carry it further, or to convince anyone of its importance. The final words of Berger's last published paper were a plea for his colleagues to take that idea seriously. "I would like to draw attention to a certain point I have made in the past. When mental work is performed, or when the type of activity designated as active conscious activity becomes manifest in any way, a considerable decrease in the amplitude of the potential oscillations of the human brain occurs in association with this shift in cortical activity." Berger could just as well have screamed into the vacuum of space. His words reached no one. One of the costs of being so far ahead of your time. On May 30th, 1941, Hans Berger took his own life. On his study wall hung a poem written by his grandfather, poet Friedrich Ruckert. "Each man faces an image of what he is meant to become. As long as he does not achieve it, he cannot achieve his full measure of peace." The Symphonies in Idle Minds. As I speak with her, Nancy Andreasen, a brunette with close-cropped hair, is approaching 80. She's a medical doctor with a PhD in English. That's not the usual combination you find in neuroscience, or anywhere in science. The PhD came first and led to a job as a professor of Renaissance literature at the University of Iowa. Then, one day while she was lying in bed for a week after a difficult pregnancy and delivery, Andreasen's mind wandered, and she had a life-altering idea, a sudden realization that she wanted to make a change. As Andreasen recounted this to me, I thought of Mary Shelley and how the story of Frankenstein had come to her, except that in Andreasen's case, the story she was creating was a rewrite of her own life. At the time of her revelation, she had just had a book about the poet John Donne accepted for publication by Princeton University Press, which for most English professors in the early days of their career would have been a great triumph. Not for her, however. "I realized I wanted to do something that changed people's lives more than writing a book on John Donne," she said. To find something that would change people's lives more than a book on John Donne is not a very tall order. A glass of Chardonnay would do it for most of us. But the something Andreasen chose was very ambitious. She decided to go to medical school and study neuropsychiatry, Berger's field. That was quite a radical step for someone who, as an English major, had taken very few science or math courses in college. She would have to build her new career from scratch. She would also have to do it at a time when women face far more barriers than they do today. This was the late 1960s. As a high school student, Andreasen had to turn down a prestigious scholarship to Harvard because her father didn't think a young girl should stray that far from home. As an academic who wanted to publish in scholarly journals, she had learned that, to be taken more seriously, it was best to hide her gender by using initials for her first and middle names in her publications. I was the first woman the university's English department had ever hired into a tenure-track position, so I was careful to publish under the gender-neutral name of N.J.C. Andreasen, she recalled in an article she wrote in The Atlantic many years later. The pressure on women who wanted to go into medicine was just as intense. Women did not have much presence in postgraduate education and were generally not welcome in medical schools. And now here she was, sitting beside her former students in virtually all male pre-med classes, aspiring to become a doctor. Despite the barriers, Andreasen succeeded at her goal. By the 1980s, she had become a world expert at PET, positron emission tomography, a method in which a radioactive substance is injected into a part of the body, in the case of Andreasen's studies, the brain, in order to create a picture of the tissues. From the point of view of neuropsychiatry and the new field of neuroscience, PET scans were the first giant technological leap beyond Berger's EEG. The technology of PET scans today is very different from what it was then. This was before the imaging boom of the 90s, Andreasen tells me. Back then, you needed to work with a radiochemist, someone who knows physics, and a physician. You had to know brain anatomy and statistics very well. And you had to be comfortable working with programmers. It wasn't like today, where everything comes in software packages that you just download. Today you get the statistics on the brain anatomy laid out for you. Andreasen's hard work paid off. She would rediscover the peculiar patterns of electrical energy produced by the idling brain, the same energy that Berger had documented and that Raichel would later study. Though Raichel would eventually coin the term default mode, Andreasen called that manner of the brain's operation the REST state, R-E-S-T. The acronym stands for Random Episodic Silent Thinking, but it is also tongue-in-cheek, because her point was that when a person's mind seems to be at rest, it isn't. It is just processing information unconsciously in a different manner. To understand how Andreasen made her discovery, you have to know a bit about how brain imaging experiments are done. Like all scientific experiments, an imaging experiment involves a control task. The idea is for the researcher to subtract the activity readings generated in each part of the brain during the control task from the readings generated by the same brain region during the experimental task. In many experiments, the control task was simply to lie still. In that case, researchers typically gave their subjects instructions like, "Let your mind go empty." They thought there would be little going on in the brain during that kind of relaxed state. "That assumption bothered me," says Andreasen. "I doubted that a mind can ever be empty." So she decided to analyze the resting brain activity itself, rather than use it as a baseline in some other study. That was when Andreasen came to the same realization that Berger had come to decades earlier. At rest, there wasn't just a little bit of activity, there was a great deal, and it was concentrated in certain structures, she says. That was a shocking contradiction to the conventional wisdom, just as shocking as it was in Berger's day. But what really fascinated Andreasen was where the brain activity was located. It took place in a network consisting of several structures that were previously thought to have little to do with one another, now called the default network. Even more intriguing, Andreasen says, it wasn't just a din, it was a symphony. The activity within the structures varied from second to second as it always does, but the different areas, though not all adjacent, were firing in synchrony. The synchronous firing of the three diverse regions told Andreasen that she was onto something. A lot is written about the size of the human brain, and especially about the size of our prefrontal cortex. But scientists are now beginning to believe that that might be a red herring, and that perhaps even more important to our intelligence and our psyche is our brain's degree of connectivity. As I described in Chapter 4, the brain is hierarchical, and the Human Connectome Project, launched in 2009, is now working on creating a map of the neural connections between structures on each successively larger scale. Even in 1995, however, Andreasen knew that many functions of the brain are served by coalitions of structures, and that the role of each structure can vary depending upon which coalition it is serving. That the regions